Let the record show that Mark, the presenter of PM on ABC Radio, has sat in my chair presenting our Little Wireless program. Writing today on ABC Online, Mark says, I'm afraid that long ABC training has given me the habit of avoiding inserting myself into the story. I'm a professional bystander. Well, let me upgrade him a little. He's an upstanding and outstanding professional bystander. But after more than 40 years as a journo, he's been forced to insert himself into a story, and what a story. A few years after joining the ABC, I think sometime in the middle of the 19th century, he went to visit his father in Washington, where Mark thought he was a senior diplomat in the British Embassy. Now, his father took him aside, swore him to secrecy, and informed his son that since the 40s, he'd been a spy working for MI6, the very organisation that, of course, famously or infamously employed Philby, Burgess, McLean, and Anthony Blunt. And a very long time after that conversation, Mark has written Light and Shadow, Memoirs of a Spy's Son, and he's sitting opposite me in the studio. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I love the studio. I had a lovely time filling in for you. And it's this, you know, this program is one of the national treasures, as are you, of course, Philip.
Mark, why did you take such an inordinately long time to write the book?
There's been a few things got in the way, such as that in the 90s I contracted a life-threatening illness, which was chronic and, as you know, mucked up my life a fair bit. And I tried to keep working as much as possible through that. And then when I was thinking about writing a book, I particularly didn't want to write a misery memoir, and I've never wanted to be defined by illness. And I am a little bit reticent about writing about myself. I think I was probably avoiding that a bit. And then I think what happened was that I found that this was a way to do a bit of long-form investigative journalism, write a bit of history.
I should make the point that as well as long-form, you do the very shortest form. You are one of the dominating figures on Twitter.
Yeah.
And every day out comes this barrage of Twitters from you, Mark, and you've got a vast following.
Yeah, one of the things about Twitter that I've just was thinking about recently is that because it is a form of such compression, I think my writing has improved enormously. You know, I think that because it forces you to write very short, simple, declarative sentences. And if you're going to be funny, you have to be funny in a way that people can't take wrongly. You have to be really careful because people don't really get sarcasm. There isn't a sarcasm font on Twitter.
They don't get it, do they? No. Anyway, let's go back to this overarching narrative of yours, because you make the really powerful point that oft the spy and the journalist are doing similar work.
Yeah, look, I think the origin of the two trades is way back in the early Renaissance, late Middle Ages. There were Florentine and Amsterdam and Antwerp bankers who employed people that they called intelligencers, who wrote newsletters for them. They were both the first spies and the first journalists, if you like. Now, the paths have diverged over the years and the centuries, and clearly in the 19th century, the rise of the journalist as we know it today came about. But the aim of both trades is to get information that other people haven't got, get it faster than anybody else. But the great difference is, well, this is what I say anyway, the great difference is that the journalist is usually trying to reach the largest audience possible and the spy is trying to reach the smallest.
Yeah. Okay, as a journalist, you deal with ambiguity, disinformation,
yes,
every day of your working life. Was it difficult for you when you discovered that ambiguity and disinformation had been part and parcel of your life, or certainly of your father's relationship with you?
Very difficult. Certainly from 1978-ish, which was when he told me in the conversation you referred to there, and 1994, when with a nod and a wink, he was one of a number of retired SIS / MI6 officers who were sort of outed in a book called The Faber Book of Espionage by Nigel West. I was not allowed to say anything about it, and I also didn't really want to say anything about it, because when you're a journalist, particularly in the 70s, you didn't want to be associated with espionage. I wasn't associated. I was associated by blood with espionage, but I never took a story from. I never have had a story dropped on me by my father or by anybody in the espionage trade, and I didn't want anyone to think, you know, to think of me as the spy's son.
Mark Colvin, sitting opposite me in our studio. Mark, describe your father at the time of his revelation to you, his physicality, his personality.
Well, my father was really quite a charismatic man. He was extremely intelligent, very funny, extremely funny. Most people who knew him remember him as being funny, witty, extremely well-read, devastating in argument. You were talking about Christopher Hitchens earlier. I knew Christopher as you did. And he had the same sort of linguistic dexterity that Christopher had, and the ability to cut people down in mid-argument that Christopher had. He certainly had never been a Trotskyite, I'll tell you that. But he was clever and funny, but he was also very moody. He could have some pretty dark clouds that followed him around sometimes. And he drank a lot, he smoked a lot. But he was certainly at that time.
That's very Christopher Hitchens as well, isn't it?
That's right. So at that time, he was doing what had been Philby's job in Washington, the liaison between MI6 and the CIA. And the significance of that is that Philby had done such an enormous damage. When Philby was in that job, he had just basically become a funnel for just about every bit of CIA product.
He was in
straight
the perfect position, wasn't
exactly.
He? Yeah.
And so the next 10, 15, 20 years are dominated by that story. You'd know the name of James Jesus Angleton, who was the counter-espionage guy in the CIA who became utterly obsessed. The book about him is called The Wilderness of Mirrors. Angleton got lost in a wilderness of mirrors where even when defectors came from Moscow, he refused to trust them. There was endless argument that somebody was not an agent, but a double agent, but a triple agent, but a quadruple agent, on and on. And so, as I say, there had been decades of rebuilding of that relationship, and the only way to do it was to the only way that that the Americans would accept somebody in that job by the mid 70s was if that person was absolutely beyond suspicion.
As indeed you are. Let's now look at your origins, and you describe your birth as an accident of empire.
Yeah, well, my paternal grandfather was a British naval officer. He was my father was born in Tokyo in 1922, and my grandfather, grandmother, and he survived the great Tokyo earthquake and fire of 1923. One of my grandmother's mementos was a melted silver ashtray, like a Dali ashtray that had survived, one of the few things that had survived in their house during the firestorm that ripped through Tokyo, which was largely wood and paper in those days. So he was Royal Navy liaison with the Japanese Navy at that time. He rose eventually to become an admiral, and then he came out here in the late 30s when Australia had largely sold off its fleet because of the Depression. And he spent several years trying to persuade the government to rebuild the Navy, and he succeeded. He managed to buy a lot of cruisers or build a lot of cruisers and frigates and destroyers.
And he meets your mum, who grew up in Western Victoria.
Yes, and she leaves Australia in 1946. They don't meet in Australia, but she's got an introduction to the family, and they meet through that sort of distant connection.
I hadn't realised you spent the first years of your life being dragged around Central and Eastern Europe.
Exactly,
and
yes.
And then your father was sent to Malaya, as it was then.
Yeah.
Why?
Because it was getting towards the fag end of the Malayan emergency, as it was called. the British had largely managed to control the communist insurgency.
See, people forget all this.
Yeah, exactly.
This whole era in Malaya is
forgotten.
Yeah.
Largely because it was a success, because they actually did the things that the Americans thought they were going to do about hearts and minds. They managed to get people on side in the kampongs and in the jungle. And Dad was running Montagna, hill tribes, sort of early warning system troops.
Very Apocalypse Now in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, through a man called Colonel Dick Noon, and I have one of the memories which I sort of tracked down in this book is as a small boy being taken out into the jungle and reviewing these troops with Colonel Dick Noon, who's a very Kipling-esque figure in long socks and khaki shorts and neatly pressed shirt. But he himself is a fascinating character. He got out of Singapore at the fall of Singapore, got to Northern Australia and joined the Zed Special Force, which is something else we don't know much about.
We can segue, of course, from Malaya to Indonesia as well.
Yes.
In the sense that...
Absolutely.
Sukarno...
Exactly. So the emergency's been put down, and then suddenly Sukarno starts getting a lot of money, not just from Moscow, but also from Mao's China. And the situation looks quite dangerous. And also Sukarno starts looking as if he's got really quite strong imperial ambitions, namely that the Federation of Malaysia, which was going to be Malaya, Singapore, Borneo, he wants to break that up and, if possible, take it all over for Indonesia. And so then there is something called Konfrontasi, which is a secret war in which Australia is also involved. But my father ran, as I have now discovered, my father ran the British end of Konfrontasi, of the operations against the Indonesians.
What a saga, Mark. Now, when you meet your dad in New York, it was the first time you visited him. Since you'd met him in Mongolia. What was he in Mongolia for?
Well, again, one of the reasons why I was diverted from thinking that he was a spook was because he had been an ambassador, and experts on espionage and experts on diplomacy told me that the British Foreign Office never gave diplomatic cover above counsellor.
Well, that was my spooks. Understanding.
Yeah.
But you know, it embassies now, might be crawling with spooks, but the boss was...
But it's now emerged in a couple of other documents that Mongolia was financed by the Mongolian embassy. The embassy in Ulaanbaatar was financed from the beginning by SIS, at least co-financed, and there was always either an ambassador or another SIS officer in there. And the reason for that was because there was a GCHQ station, that is to say a signals directorate station, that was trying to monitor everything between China and Russia.
Let's explain, or tell me, the mood, the atmosphere, when your father tells you the story. Does he do so... matter of factly, does he do
when he tells me that
his yes, own
well,
story?
He calls me. I'm in New York, going to CBGB's to try and see the Ramones, basically, and you know, hanging around, going to art galleries, and you know, just my first ever visit to New York. It's amazing. And he says, "Look, I'm coming up to see you because you're coming down to stay with me for a couple of weeks, and I need to talk to you." So he takes me to this gentleman's club called the Knickerbocker Club, which is like an English gentleman's club. And we eat lamb cutlets and drink claret. And he tells me that he's got to swear me to secrecy. And the reason is that there are going to be some other SIS operatives staying with us when I'm down there. And I need to be very careful what I say. And I need to basically be deaf, dumb and blind during that period. And then he also tells me the whole sort of thing about how the whole thing works.
How do you read it after decades of obfuscation? He suddenly unburdens himself.
Well, I read it that he actually needed to tell me, but that was the genuine reason, that there were going to be quite a lot of dinner parties at which there were people whose names
I was... So it could no longer be concealed.
That's exactly right.
In effect.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were listening outside.
I was. I was fascinated, and really particularly by the sewers.
Well, that's what I want to raise now, because Osama points out the significance of the sewers invasion, an absolute turning point in Middle East history. Your father, once again, is involved.
That's right. Well, so I'm 4 years old in 1956, and Dad goes to America. That's all I know, is that he's gone to America. He sends me back a postcard, which is a postcard of a Boeing Stratocruiser, which was, you know, the Airbus or 747 of its time. And it's a postcard of it's a cutaway version. So you can see through the sides of the Stratocruiser into the comfortable armchairs, the bar, the beds. And to a 4-year-old child, this was absolutely fantastic. He brought me a jigsaw of the same thing. And I asked him in 1994, I think, I asked him, you know, I was going through some of my childhood memories. Was this right? Do I remember this right? And what were you doing in America? So he tells me, well, I was the junior member of the delegation from MI6 that went to Washington to try and persuade the CIA to go in with us and the French and the Israelis on the Suez invasion. So I then started to track this down, and there's a guy called Scott Lucas, a professor in a Middle East specialist. I'm not sure if I can use that word Middle East anymore after listening to Osama. But Scott had done a freedom of information search and managed to get a full account of this meeting. And this meeting is just quite terrifying. I mean, even in terms of what you and Osama were talking about, this meeting is just quite astonishing, because what happens is that George Young, who's ex-special operations executive in World War II and is now the deputy director general, the person under M or C in MI6, George Young, and he's a real cowboy, George Young, too. Historically, he's a fascinating character. But he leads this delegation. My dad's just basically along as a stenographer, or, you know, the junior member. He's quite young and inexperienced at this stage. And at this meeting, George Young proposes to the CIA that they come in with the Brits and the French, not only on a plan to take back the Suez Canal from Colonel Nasser. By the way, Anthony Eden, the Prime Minister, had rung a junior minister called Anthony Nutting, and this is quite well attended, this is recorded by Nutting himself. Around this time, Eden rang Nutting and said, "Don't you understand? I don't want any of this destabilization of Nasser. I don't want any of this shilly-shallying around. I want Nasser murdered. I want Nasser murdered." This was the license to kill. So I think there's not any doubt that what George Young takes to Washington is sanctioned from the top. And what he takes is a plan not only to take back the Suez Canal, not only to destabilize and murder Nasser, destabilize Nasser's regime and murder the man himself, but also to, at the same time, destabilize the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and bring down the government of Syria, a tripartite operation which would have just thrown, as we know what the, unfortunately, since 2003, we know what happens when you create vacuums in the Middle East.
But of course they were dealing with a US president who knew war all too well, and who tried as hard as he could not to get America embroiled in another one.
That's right. And also, I think what's really significant about Eisenhower is that he had spent, whatever that was, 2 years building the operation that created D-Day, building the operation to invade France. And he knew that if you're going to do big stuff like that, you didn't do it as a cowboy operation. You didn't do it a couple of months after you first got the idea. you built gigantic logistics operations and you built enormous intelligence operations. I mean, some of the great stories about D-Day are about how Hitler got fooled by all kinds of fraudulent operations. But you do all that. And so Eisenhower, I think, was much too level-headed ever to think that it could work, let alone whether he wanted it to work, which is another question.
I want you to tell me briefly about how some MI6... blokes got stuck into you because you'd made comments about Robert Menzies and Petrov.
Yeah, well, I'm sitting at dinner with these blokes that I'm supposed to be deaf, dumb and blind about, and I'm sitting there and they say, they're just sort of asking me about Australian politics and intelligence. And so I say, well, you know, most people think that the whole Petrov thing was a setup. By Menzies, and that it was done to win an election. And they got extremely angry and they piled into me, and it didn't help that there was a bloke called Alan Weinstein there who'd just written the book about Alger Hiss. But really what they did was get stuck into me with a lot of evidence. And what I know now, what I can say now, is that what they told me obliquely, but they were too indiscreet, I know, because Dad told me later to forget the entire conversation. They basically told me that they didn't say we've got the Venona decrypts. They didn't say we've deciphered the cables from London, from Moscow, which said that Petrov was genuinely a senior operative, and his wife was too. But that's basically what they were telling me. And they were really angry about it because to them, through their eyes, it was one of the great intelligence coups of a generation. And I was carrying on as though it was just a political stunt.
The overlap between our two stories tonight, between you and the wonderfully named Osama, is entirely and utterly coincidental. But it also brings up one of the great names in Kermit Roosevelt, and you have a connection with Kermit Roosevelt.
Well, I do, both directly and indirectly. I met him on that trip to Washington. I went to half-brother and half-sister were invited to I think it was a Halloween party, actually, and it was, so it must have been around this time of year. But I remember there were various sort of slightly Halloweenish things. Anyway, it might have been, whatever. We went to his house and he was this very urbane, what the Americans call a Brahmin, you know, a sort of Boston Brahmin type of thing. He was of the Roosevelt family, tall, thin man, and very welcoming. And I didn't know anything about him at the time. But then later I end up in Tehran, and the entire Iranian political situation is completely overshadowed by, you were talking about him as an Arabist, but he was also a Persianist, which is a very different thing, as you know. And it was Kermit Roosevelt in 1953 who designed and led the operation which brought down Mossadegh, the leader in Iran, and the person who was, on the one hand, was trying to lead the Shah into something more like a constitutional monarchy than a dictatorial monarchy, but on the other hand was saying that the arrangement that BP, British Petroleum, had for its oil was grossly inequitable and that Iran should get much more for its oil. And that was obviously the part that the Americans couldn't stand, and the British, the great Satan and the little Satan is what the Iranians call the British, the Americans and the British, and it all stems from Kermit Roosevelt in 1953.
Going back to your dad, he was much more than a simple Cold War warrior, wasn't he? I understand that, yes, he learned to detest communism, but his attitude seemed more calibrated.
Yeah, I think his idea about communism, I think the reason why he was such a dedicated Cold Warrior was that he had a romantic attachment to England itself, and I think very much England as well as Britain, but he was very much an Englishman. But he also, when I was a small child and we were in southern Austria, when I was still a small child and we went to Vienna, and during exactly 60 years ago this week, this is the thing we haven't talked about Suez, and I think it's a really important thing to say about Suez, is that not only was it a catastrophe, not only was it a military disaster, not only was it the beginning of the end of the British, the forcing of the British to understand that their empire was dying, but it, and this is the worst thing about it, I think, it diverted the world's attention away from what else was going on this day 60 years ago, the Hungarian uprising. The Hungarians had said to the Russians, enough is enough. And the Soviet Union had said at the beginning, within 3 days, I think about today as we speak, had turned around and said, they put out a statement on Pravda saying, countries should have some right to self-determination. It looked as though they were sending a message that said they would let Hungary have some degree of, or greater degree of autonomy. The British invaded Suez. The whole thing was a catastrophe. The entire world was focused on Suez, and in came the tanks within, what is it, about 6 or 7 days from now, 60 years ago, the tanks roll in.
I remember it so vividly because at that time I was a young member of the Communist Party.
Right. And it would have changed you, I'm sure.
Well, it did. It was a shattering experience.
And it was deeply, deeply emotionally powerful for my father as well.
And, of course, later it would have its echo when the tanks rolled into Wenceslas Square.
In 68, when I was 16.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think you after 68...
It was impossible to be a good, loyal party member.
We could have another whole program about 68.
Let's do that. let's do that. Your father lived long enough to see your career burgeon and blossom. Was he proud of you?
He was very proud of me, actually. He was really proud of me. And the other thing which I was talking to somebody else about today is that we had...
You can mention Richard.
Richard Feider. But although we'd had a lot of differences over the years, and he had this tendency to bolt off and be an absent parent at times, when I got very sick in 94, he was just there all the time. He would just come in and sit beside my bedside. And I was in the hospital for months, and he'd come in for days on end. And he was getting old by then sometimes, and my lungs were filled with fluid, and I would drown if I leant back. And so I couldn't talk much, and sometimes he'd fall asleep, but it was just companionable silence, and we were very good friends in the end.
Mark, thank you for coming in. Mark Colvin's book, Light and Shadow, Memoirs of a Spy's Son, and it's not simply a portrait of his father, it's also a very detailed self-portrait, and comes highly commended. It's published this very day by Melbourne University Press. Good on you, Mark.